is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batson with Bill Raggio, Tom Jocelyn of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They do a highly recommended podcast, Generation Jihad, when they have time, given all the information coming in from the collapse of Afghanistan these last weeks. And their most recent iteration addresses what we know and what we don't know about al-Qaeda, what we need to know, because al-Qaeda remains a transnational organization with representatives in the Arabian Gulf, in the Islamic Maghreb, in sub-Saharan Africa, in East Africa. There are several other versions. One, of course, we're looking at in Afghanistan. Another one we're looking at in the subcontinent. Tom, I begin with you on what we know about al-Qaeda following the success of Taliban in Afghanistan. Is there indication that al-Qaeda is re-energized or reawakened or getting new financing? I note we had that story just last week about several al-Qaeda financiers being sanctioned in their refuge in Turkey. Is that an indication of strength or just business as usual, Tom?
Well, you know, John, I would say this. There were basically all the years Bill and I have been doing this, there were two models of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. One was the dominant sort of herd model, which said that al-Qaeda was basically defunct and was defeated, degraded. You know, Bill likes to say they had all these different D words to emphasize that basically al-Qaeda was on death's door. And then there was the reporting and analysis we did, which documented al-Qaeda's persistent and resilient presence across Afghanistan. And in our model, al-Qaeda was heavily invested in the Taliban's insurgency against the government in Kabul, was heavily invested in defeating the U.S.-backed government and the U.S. military in Afghanistan. And so the fact from our perspective is this is actually a major victory for al-Qaeda. And in fact, al-Qaeda says that this is an historic victory in Afghanistan. I think that more details are going to come out. But here's the thing. One of the ways you can tell that al-Qaeda was integrated into this whole operation all along was just looking at the cabinet ministers named by the Taliban. 17 of the 33 were sanctioned as early as January and February of 2001, John. So they were known by the UN to be bad actors with ties to al-Qaeda and terrorist and affiliated terrorist groups more than 20 years ago, and they were sanctioned for that 8 months before 9/11. So this is why we say that the Taliban 2.0 is really the Taliban 1.0, because these guys were just waiting to take over once again. But look at the guy who's the head of state for the Taliban, the guy who's they call him prime minister in some sources, but we know that's not a real – they don't have a real European-style of government. But the guy is named Hassan Akhund. What was he responsible for? Well, prior to 9/11, after the U.S. embassy bombings that al-Qaeda conducted in Africa – it was Hassan Akhund who came out and defied the UN. When the UN said, turn over Osama bin Laden, Akhund came out and said, we will not turn over Osama bin Laden at any price. He was then the foreign minister of the Taliban. Today he's the so-called head of state for the group. We've talked about Sirajuddin Haqqani, the interior minister. He's an al-Qaeda man. We've talked about all these other figures. The head of the intelligence for the Taliban was a former Gitmo detainee named Abdulhaq Wasiq. He was sanctioned by the UN. Why? Because he worked with al-Qaeda. And we can go on and on and on like this. You mentioned Khost earlier. The new governor of Khost is Nabi Omari, another former Gitmo detainee. When he was detained at Gitmo, why was he detained? And why was he sanctioned by the UN? Because he worked with al-Qaeda as a member of the Qaeda network. So the bottom line, John, is that al-Qaeda was integrated into this whole insurgency and now this whole government that took over Afghanistan. That's consistent with what we've been reporting for years. And I think a lot of people have failed to understand that.
Bill, at least since April, at least since the United States made the announcement that it was leaving at such and such a date, 9/11 or the end of August, at least since then, there's been a consistent theme of Taliban denying or refuting the claim that al-Qaeda was present or in any fashion was working with Taliban as it advanced on Kabul. Has that gone away, that denial, Bill? I know I'm looking for something that's not there anymore, but we talked week after week, I know because I've made this available to my audience, week after week about how, well, that's al-Qaeda, but they're denying it. Do you see any change in their rhetoric, Bill?
No, no change whatsoever. The Taliban spokesmen continue to come out and say al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan. And what they've even continue with their 9/11, their version of 9/11 trutherism and say there's no evidence that Al-Qaeda even carried out 9/11, which is funny because Osama bin Laden and other senior Al-Qaeda leaders and Al-Sahab often take credit. Well, bin Laden, of course, took credit for it when he was alive. So, yeah, there's zero change whatsoever. I mean, and this is the irony of all this. The U.S. says, you know, look, we have to consider, you know, the Taliban as a, you know, General Milley called, or McKenzie, I'm sorry, the commander at CENTCOM, called them at our Afghan partners. Our partners who denied that Al-Qaeda carried out 9/11 and denies that Al-Qaeda remains in Afghanistan to this day.
Tom, I come to you about Al-Qaeda's presence right now, what we know, not just in Afghanistan, but everywhere. Is there any indication of new offensives or new organizations worldwide, because certainly they have the money for it?
Well, you know, look, the first priority for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban is to consolidate their control and their regime in Afghanistan. This is the main thing Al-Qaeda was fighting for in Afghanistan all along, was to resurrect the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which was lost after the 9/11 hijackings. You know, this was a liability for Al-Qaeda, that basically the 9/11 hijackings caused the Taliban to lose the only religiously legitimate regime in their eyes on the planet. Well, now that regime is back. So they now have to consolidate its authority and its control across Afghanistan. They want to take some time to basically further embolden and enforce their version of Sharia law across Afghanistan. These are big matters for them to do. However, you know, one part of the model that Bill and I have been rebutting for so long is this idea that the Taliban is this purely nationalist cause that just wants to fight in Afghanistan, take over Afghanistan. Well, there's a whole bunch of evidence showing that's false, that in fact much of the Taliban, which is in bed with Al-Qaeda and intertwined with Al-Qaeda, had aspirations not only to take over Afghanistan once again, which is something that Washington denied, but actually to export the jihad, to take over territory in Pakistan, to embolden the jihad in Kashmir, to launch attacks in India and elsewhere throughout the region and indeed the world. So I think that there's plenty of evidence along those lines. I think that the first priority for the Taliban Al-Qaeda is to consolidate their regime and their power. It's only, you know, we're only a few weeks in now, about a month into them owning Afghanistan once again. That's going to take some time. But, you know, we shouldn't be surprised when you see the uptick of jihadists flowing out of Afghanistan and plots tracing back to Afghanistan.
Bill, I've seen rhetoric from ISIS, wherever it is. I never know the source. But anyway, a quote denouncing the Taliban as, I believe the term was, dirty nationalists or filthy nationalists. Do you see ISIS propaganda regularly denouncing the Taliban, Bill?
Yeah, that's a common theme from the Islamic State. They even call the Taliban basically a tool of the United States, or a servant of the U.S. and the West, which is kind of ironic because that was the Taliban's rhetoric against the Afghan government. So yeah, that animosity within the Islamic State, Khorasan province, towards the Taliban, it continues. The Islamic State demands allegiance to its emir. Nothing else will do. And it will, and as long as it exists, it'll remain a threat to the Taliban. Again, I view the Islamic State as more a thorn in the Taliban's side than a real threat for its ability to govern.
Final, Tom, I've done a story with Tunku Varadarajan of the Journal about the Afghan cricket team. And you tell me, you know who's in charge of the Afghan cricket team. There's some controversy whether they'll be able to do a world tour because of the Taliban's anti-female, anti-human stance. Who's in charge? We have about a minute, Tom. Who's in charge of the Afghanistan cricket team now that the Taliban is in charge?
Well, you know, John, after the Taliban takeover, there's uncertainty about what role these Afghan sports teams will continue to play internationally, because, you know, the Taliban obviously has its own rules that don't comport with the way things were done under the former, now deposed Afghan government. Well, early on, the Taliban dispatched Anas Akhani, who is the brother of Siraj Akhani, the interior minister. This is a family that's deeply intertwined with Al-Qaeda. They dispatched Anas Akhani to act as the diplomat with the cricket team to say all is well and you can continue to play. You know, Anas Akhani is basically the Ron Burgundy of jihadism. He's sort of vapid. He'll just repeat whatever they put in front of him. But he's sort of the perfect diplomat from that perspective, because he can play nice with the cricket team and pretend like all will be well. And so it's interesting that he in particular was picked for this mission.
Tom Jocelyn, Bill Rajo, the Foundation for the Defense Defense of Democracy, Senior Fellows, Long War Journal, and Generation Jihad is the podcast. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.